Okay, this is the second shiur in the series on Kuntres HaChesed Rav Dessler. Okay, what did we see yesterday? That there is a choice between taking and giving, netilah in Hebrew. That those who are takers, number one, sometimes brutally deprive others of their property without compensating at all. Sometimes, out of fear of the government or externally imposed scruples, they will pay. They will not cheat. But the payment is made only in order to enable more taking. They look at it as a kind of investment, which will increase their profits in the long run. And such people are characterized by brutal competition and joy when their competitors fail, whether they have an accident or they can take advantage of their ignorance. And this commitment to taking for oneself is the root of all evils in terms of human personality and human behavior. By contrast, there is the power of giving, which is an imitation of the Creator, because in the whole of the creation, He's only giving. And therefore, it is the highest position that a person can be in. And the last thing we said yesterday was, if you imagine a society which is perfect, in which everybody's giving, it seems like a contradiction. If everybody's giving, to whom are they giving? If no one is getting, to use a neutral term. I told you that Rav Dessler distinguishes between taking and receiving. Physically, a taker and a receiver both get. The item is transferred to him. But the psychology, the motivation behind it is entirely different. One is taking for himself as the goal of the interaction. The other is receiving as a means to providing the other with an opportunity to give. And therefore, it's a giving on both sides. That's what he's going to talk about in more detail today. But at any rate, chapter 3, he now says, given that I've described to you the power of taking and its evils, how shall we look at the other side, the tzaddikim? These are people who, number one, their whole goal is to give. And if they take, if they receive, if they get, the getting is only as a means to giving. The exact opposite of the first group, who may pay for something. They're not cheating. They'll pay. But the paying is only for the sake of making a bigger profit. The whole goal is to get more. Here are people who get, but the point of the getting is as a means to giving. For example, imagine a surgeon who has invented new methods of life-saving surgery, and he uses it to save people's lives. Now, surgeons are very high-paid people. He does surgery for charity cases for nothing, and he shares his techniques with others. He doesn't keep them to himself so that he can have a monopoly on the techniques and make more money. He's motivated by giving to the world what he can give, which is health. Will he take a salary? The answer is, in the normal conditions, yes. Because if he doesn't take a salary, he'll have no house to live in, he'll have no clothes to wear, he'll have no bed to sleep in, he'll have no food to eat, and he won't be able to continue doing surgery and giving people health. So he takes a salary, but his goal in taking the salary is to enable him to do more surgery to help people. So is he getting money? Yes, he's getting money. But for him, the getting is a means to giving. So you can't look at it externally. You can't look at the person's interactions with the world and ask, is he getting or isn't he getting? The question is, what is the psychological springboard which motivates the getting? For takers, there may be giving up certain things, but the giving up is a means to more taking. For givers, there may be getting certain things, but the getting is a means to more giving. So you have to do an in-depth psychological analysis rather than just looking at the surface. Now, he says, I'll bring you two examples, one from one of the earliest people in history and one from a much later person in history, so you'll get a picture of how this is done. I must tell you, as you'll see, his analysis, although it's based on Chazal, is quite strikingly creative. The verse says that Hanoch walked with God. Hanoch is in the first generations from Adam to the flood. And he, say Chazal, was a tzaddik. He lived a relatively short period of time, 365 years, when everybody else was living from 890 to 960. He walked with God. He was a tzaddik. He was fragile. And God took him early so that he should not be affected by the deterioration of the generations. Now, the Medrash says that Hanoch was a shoemaker. He was a shoemaker, stitching shoes. And that every stitch, he created mystical unifications for his creator. Miyachid Yichudim is a term that's used throughout the mystical literature. It usually refers to having in mind all sorts of deep mystical concepts so as to bring into play these upper forces and powers to have an effect on the world. So, Rav Testi says, I heard in the name of Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim, who explained this in the following way. He said, the intention of this statement is not that while he was stitching the shoes, his mind was in the upper worlds and the upper spheres and making connections between divine names and so forth and so on. Because that's forbidden. It's forbidden by Jewish law. Remember, in those days, when you made shoes, someone came into your shop, you measured his foot, and they were the shoes made to order. So you're not making the put on the shelf and have somebody in, come in and fit. No, you're making shoes fit to order. So you have to make shoes that will fit the person. That's what you're being paid to do. If you're stitching blind, you know, just letting it go, and you're thinking about the upper worlds, you're not giving the buyer fair value for the money that he's paying you. So it says, Rosh Hashanah Salat, it can't be that that's what it means. How could he turn his mind away from the work that he's being paid to do? No. So what does Chazal mean when they say he was making mystical unions? It means that he set his heart and his thought in every stitch, that it should be a good stitch and a strong stitch, so that the shoes should be good shoes, so that the person that he's making them for should enjoy them, should benefit from them. Now, how does that qualify as making mystical unions? How could you take the words of the Midrash, Miyachid Yichudim, making mystical unions to the world, and apply it to someone who's making the best shoes that he can? Okay, maybe other explanations will violate the law, and therefore the other explanation is certainly problematic. But how can you make this into the right explanation? And he says, I'll tell you why. Because in making the shoes, the best shoes that he can, he has in mind the wearer. He's seeing the foot in the shoe. He's watching the person walking, and he's stitching to make sure that it serves the wearer in the best possible way. He's attached to God's way of dealing with the world. He's representing God in the world. What is God doing in the world but creating a world and running a world to benefit us, to give us the greatest possible benefit? That's how you create unions in the world. You do for the world what God is doing for the world. You stand for God in the world. You represent God in the world. Not by turning your mind away from what you're doing, especially when you're paid to do work for somebody else, and forget about the world that's in front of you. That's how he made those unions. Because Hanoch didn't want anything else, just one purpose and one hope, one ambition, to be like God. To be like God in the most profound possible way. And he therefore avoided another problem, because if you have a failure in your work, even if it's an unintentional failure, it's an accidental failure, but it's an accidental failure because you didn't pay attention, because you weren't sufficiently focused, then that's also a crime. And then he adds in another detail, which we're going to see in a little bit. I'll just translate it, but he'll explain it more. That when he takes for it, when he gets paid for it, he knows that he's not getting paid more than what he's giving. We said that one of the characteristics of takers is that they don't pay any attention to the relative value of what they're taking and what they're giving, except that they should make a profit. That's how they'll pay their workers insufficient wages on the grounds that there are lots of people who need to work. So if I don't hire you, I'll hire somebody else. And I don't care whether you can live on it and support your children or not. It's a free market. It's work competition, and I'm taking the worker at the least, at the lowest value. No, one of the things that a giver has in mind is, if he's paid for his work, to make sure that he gives more value than he receives. So he can be sure of that. We'll see a very striking example of that from Hillel. The second example, he says, comes from the Chafetz Chaim. So we're going from Hanoch in the first generations of history down to the Chafetz Chaim, who died in 1933. We saw this great tzaddik with our own eyes. So we saw him in our own generation. He didn't want to earn money from his Torah, and he became a shopkeeper. And the merchandise that he sold was always the best. And when he measured it out, he always measured it out overflowing. In other words, if you're giving a cup of flour, the cup of flour is when the top is flat. But he didn't do that. He piled up the flour up over the top, so he's giving more than a cup. And he always made sure when he weighed out on the scales, that what he gave to the buyer weighed the scale down. It was never even. He put enough in to weigh the scale down. No, if you're going to behave that way with your customers, obviously, everybody's going to come to you, right? You're giving them all a good deal. And he said, so now, what do you think his response was, the Chafetz Chaim? I'm making sure that I'm giving more than I'm getting. I'm making sure that the customer is being well served. I'm doing it all for his benefit. And now, of course, because he does that, all the customers are coming to him. His concern is, what will the other shopkeepers do? What will the other shopkeepers do? I'm depriving them of their parnassah, of their livelihood. And therefore, he made a rule that he only opened the shop 1 or 2 hours a day so that he couldn't serve everybody. And the others will have to go to the other shopkeepers, whatever their customs are, but he didn't want to take away the parnassah, the livelihood of other shopkeepers. Just enough to earn the money that he needs and close the shop. And that's enough. And then he'll close it. So that the others will be able to make a living. And he analyzed afterwards when he did this, and he saw that didn't help. They crowded into his shop for the 1 or 2 hours, and they bought up everything. And therefore, in the end, he closed the shop entirely. He closed the shop entirely. And he gave up being a shopkeeper. Why? Because he's a giver. And a giver has to take into account all the consequences. And it'll be no good if I'm giving to my customers and thereby taking away the livelihood from other people. That's not the kind of giving that I'm interested in. I'm interested in giving that's giving. And therefore he gave it up. So these examples of people whose orientation is giving rather than the opposite orientation. Now he quotes a chazal, a very challenging chazal. Greater is he who benefits from the work of his own hands more than a person who fears God. Greater is he who benefits, in other words, he supports himself. He derives his own livelihood from the work of his own hands, and he who fears God. How could that be? What is chazal trying to communicate to us there? So he says, someone who benefits from the work of his own hands, he's the person on the very high level, because he's a person who can make sure that in an exchange between himself and others, he can give more than he receives. When such a person acts and takes care that he shouldn't stumble, he doesn't earn money through his intelligence, wisdom, his umanus is a kind of expert skill. Because in all of those, it's very hard to have an objective value. No, he will choose to work through the effort of his hands and the sweat of his brow. Simple work. Work that's not intellectual work and not skilled work, which is paid by an objective amount, simple value of an amount. And when he does that, and he makes sure that he gives more than he gets, then he's on a very great level. Why is he greater than the person who fears God? That he'll explain in a minute. Now, as he's going to say, there's an example of this that people know, but we don't understand what the example is teaching us. Chazal say that Hillel was a woodchopper. He wasn't a woodchopper his whole life. There was a period in his life when he earned his living by chopping wood. So if that's asked a very simple question. You're talking about Hillel, one of the great geniuses of the age. Why was he earning money by chopping wood? Couldn't he have hired himself out as a financial advisor to someone with a business empire and say, listen, I'll work for you an hour a day, I'll solve your economic problems, your organizational problems? Wouldn't it have been better to do that and spend the rest of the time learning, sitting in the base medrash, interacting with other Talmid Chachamim? Now you'll tell me, someone as great as Hillel, even when he's chopping wood, can be thinking in Torah. That's true. That's true. He certainly can, and I'm sure he certainly did. It's still not comparable to the Torah that you can have when you're sitting in the base medrash. The Marshal, who wrote a commentary on almost the whole of the Talmud, I think it's a Sanhedrin where he skips a number of chapters. It's blank. And he says, I didn't write up my comments. I have comments. I didn't write them up on this because when they were learning this in the yeshiva, I was at the fair in Leipzig. He was a merchant. And therefore, I wasn't together with the people in the yeshiva when they were learning it, and therefore, I don't want to write up my chiddushim. I don't want to write up my comments. Because it didn't have the benefit of the discussion of the people in the yeshiva. Talk about the Marsha. Right? So why did Hillel do this? Right? Now, we read about him being a woodchopper. I don't know, you think humility, you think, but you don't ask the simple question, why do that, and what about the loss to Talmud Torah? He says, a gigantic moral. He said Hillel was perfecting his character trait of loving kindness, of giving. How do you perfect the character trait of giving? When you have an interaction, you make sure that you give more than you get. As he said in this paragraph, how can you be sure you give more than you get? If you're paid for your cleverness, if you're paid for your wisdom, if you're paid for your craftsmanship, your artistry, it's very difficult to know what the objective value is. They sell a Picasso today for $158 million. How do you know whether you're getting more or less than what you really deserve? But if you're a woodchopper, you're paid per pound of wood or per bushel of wood. And it's a common price and everybody gets paid the same thing. It's purely mechanical work. And therefore, you can make sure that you give extra. You can make sure, and that's how you, those in every interaction, you know, I'm giving more than I'm getting. Now, I hope someday you will have the privilege of associating with big people. I've been connected with my Rebbe since 1962, Boston Rebbe. And I can testify from experience that he's very careful in every interaction that the person he's interacting with should get more than the Rebbe gets. The Rebbe usually often gets nothing. But if he gets some kind of support or some kind of help or some kind of facility, the person he's interacting with always gets more. Always gets more. He gets his personal development. He gets advice on how to run his business or his marriage or how to take care of his children. It's that commitment. Why? Why do I want to make sure the other person gets more? Because I'm trying to represent God in the world. And God is doing everything he's doing for the sake of benefiting the other. So I, if I want to be godlike, I have to be able to feel in every interaction that I'm benefiting the other guy. I am getting something, so how am I benefiting him? Because I'm giving more than I'm getting. I'm giving him extra. Now, unlike the Chafetz Chaim, Hillel was not able to produce enough wood to put all the other wood choppers out of business. So there's no question of competition and somebody else losing his livelihood. But he made sure that when he gave. And it was worth it to lose those months, however many months it was, or years, of enhanced Talmud Torah in order to root this character trait in himself. It means that the character traits, in a certain sense, are more fundamental than Talmud Torah. And studying Torah doesn't guarantee that you will develop those character traits. Something which could be put in today's context, and thought about. Yeah.
Then why is it that there are so many people that sit and learn Torah all day and don't?
Why is it that people sit and learn Torah all day and don't work to develop their character traits? I must tell you, first of all, in the context of yeshiva, to a certain extent, character traits can be worked on. I remember when I first went to yeshiva, I noticed something which to this day I feel is worthy of note. You have, let's say, 150 people sitting in a big room, all studying the same subject. I came in as a beginner, and I learned very quickly, it's this unwritten rule, you're allowed to interrupt anybody if you have a question. Now, you know, they're sitting in pairs, study pairs. I was a beginner. I would go up to somebody who was more advanced than I, or I and my study partner, where we were totally lost, go up, and we could interrupt anybody, and they had to answer us. There was no question. Listen, you know, wait till one of the teachers is available, or you know, I'll see you after hours, or whatever. I'm doing my own research. I'm doing my own learning. No, absolutely not. Say again?
Why are you allowed to do that?
Now you should be able to tell from his question that the expression and development of loving kindness is how you show yourself to be godly. So, what are you learning Torah for? Aren't you learning Torah to be a better representative of God in this world? Aren't you doing it to internalize God's rules, God's values, God's thoughts, so that you'll act more like God? And now a person comes to you and he needs help. Like, how can you say, I'm learning God's law so as not to do what God is doing in the world? Right? It's like we spoke the other day about the rule that if there's a mitzvah to be done, nobody else can do it. You're supposed to stop learning Torah to do it. But here it's specifically loving kindness that's needed in this context. If a guy's married, it's a very serious thing. I want you to know, Revolba wrote a little essay called Kurdus Chasonim, Madrich Chasonim, which he only sold to Chasonim privately in the house. It was never published on the street. And in it, he writes that we face a terrible, terrible problem. That in the yeshiva world, typically the student is trained to be selfish. He has all his meals provided for, and his family takes care of his clothes, and he doesn't have to earn any money, and he's sitting there and learning. And when he gets married, it's a big challenge. He's got to do a 180-degree turn. It's got to be a tremendous reorientation. Now, he wrote this to make the point forcefully, to try to train the prospective chassan to think carefully about what he's doing. What I'm saying is that in a rightly run yeshiva, you do have aspects of this. Many yeshivas today require of advanced students to spend at least an hour a day with beginning students, helping them to get started. So that means at least an hour a day, this advanced student is giving up his advanced studies to be able to help a beginner. So there is a way of working it out. That's part of the answer. And the other part of the answer is that today's structure of study of Torah is really, to a great extent, a compromise. It is not done the way the Gemara says it should be done. It is not done the way many Rishonim and early Achronim said it should be done. It's a compromise with circumstances where many Gedolim felt that if we don't compromise, we'll have nothing left. There are many compromises. First of all, you are supposed to learn all of Tanakh and know it 5 years, from 5 to 10, learn nothing but Tanakh and know every verse. And by the way, when they learned it, they didn't have vowels. So they learned Job and Isaiah and Daniel, which is written in Aramaic. They learned to pronounce all of them correctly, and they learned what they meant. That took 5 years. Then it'd be 5 years to learn all of Mishnayos. So it's a start Gemara when you're 15. Furthermore, as I heard from Rabbi Heinemann in Baltimore many years ago, the order of learning should be practical laws first. Because the goal of learning, the most direct goal of learning, is to be able to do. So there you are learning theoretical Bava Kamma. What happens when this guy's ox gores that guy's a cow, right? And you're not a farmer, and you're never going to see an ox, and you can tell an ox from a donkey, right? You know, but you're not learning about Shabbos, you're not learning about brachos, you're not learning about holidays, you're not learning about... So there's all sorts of compromises that have crept in. Iyun, where a person can spend 8 years in Yeshiva Gedola and say, I know very well, thoroughly, 75 daf. 75 daf out of 2,700. Right, and the rest of Shas, and 10 dozen subjects in Shas he's never even looked at. As someone who told me he was trained in Europe, he told me, I regret the fact that there were so many subjects like Tum and Tara, which he said we never touched, and when the Gemara talks about it, like in the first parak of Sachem and other places, they skip it. Right? So he says, I'm an Ama Oretz. I'm a complete ignoramus in the subject. He told me that when he was 60. The person was learning for the rest of his life, but he never went into it. So there are lots of compromises that have been made. If you look how the Maral writes about how Talmud Torah should be done, okay, I'm not criticizing it. Compromises were made for the force of necessity, but they are compromises. And what Hillel did was, to a certain extent, exceptional. What did Reb Shlomo Salanter say? Reb Shlomo Salanter said, I'm sorry, the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon of Vilna said, the purpose of a Jew's life is to create good midos, good character traits. That's what you're here for, he said. He who spent 18 hours a day learning. The purpose that you're here for is that. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter said it's easier to learn the whole of the Talmud than to break one bad character trait. So we have statements on record that express these ideas. Anyway. Okay, maybe I'll... Since we've gone this far, it'll come up again later, but maybe I'll give you one more illustration of this, which is Rav Tester's Chiddush, which is really awesome. Here's Abraham being visited by God. It was the third day after the circumcision. He's ill and God's visiting him. Picks up his eyes and he sees three travelers and runs to give them hospitality. So Chazal say, from this you see, greater is giving hospitality to travelers than receiving the divine presence. Good. That's true. From what Abraham did, you can deduce that. But of course, some of the commentators ask, how did Abraham know? We can see from what he did, but how did he know? Now, Rav Dessler attacks this problem, for me as a philosopher, you know, I'm thrilled with it. You can't say that A is greater than B if it's apples and oranges. If they're really two different dimensions, two different considerations, it'd be very difficult. Maybe you can sometimes work it out, but it's very difficult to say that one is greater than the other. To say that one is greater than the other, the most direct approach is to say it's two instances of the same category, and you can see that within the same category, one is bigger than the other. So now, Rav Dessler says, what is God doing in the world? He's giving. Giving and benefiting. What is the highest thing for a human being to do in the world? Give and benefit. Now ask yourself, what role is Abraham playing in the two instances, in the two experiences? Receiving God's presence. Now the words of Chazal are gold. And once you come to understand the concept, you find that Chazal's words are chosen with such care, with such precision. Kabbalas Pnei Hashchina. Kabbalah. He's receiving God's presence. When he goes out to the wayfarers, he's providing for someone's needs. In which instance is he more God-like? When he's providing for the needs of the wayfarers. He's doing what God is doing for them. He's providing for needs. He's benefiting. So that's what Odessa says. It's greater because in the dimension of being God-like as a giver, This is a bigger position of being a giver. That, to me, that's awesome. That's awesome. Now, many people, when they hear this, ask, so let's say I'm davening. There's a knock on the door. And I could tell that it's a wayfarer who needs help, or it's a person who's asking for charity. Should I break off davening in order to help the person? And it's the person who's asking the question usually knows the law is no, you don't do that. But why not? If you're telling me that's, that the giving is greater. Anyone have a clue what the answer is?
On his level, he wasn't stopping anything to start anything.
Oh, the answer is much more direct than that. Much more direct than that. What are you doing? Even if not, what are you doing when you're praying? What are you doing? You're asking God to give to the whole of the Jewish people and ultimately to the whole of the world. And when you're asking is a way of getting it done. So what you're doing is giving. You're involved in giving. And you're involved in giving to the Jewish people as a whole and to the world as a whole. So it's really giving and giving. And then there's no proof that helping this person is better than praying for the health of the whole Jewish people. Right? So it works out beautifully. You see, that's when an analysis is deep. When you can classify each particular case and make it work that way. But this is the fundamental idea. Giving is the fundamental position of the person because that's what he was created to do. You with me? There's one more chazal, which I don't think Rav Tester brings, but is relevant here. I have it in my notes on the page. The Gemara says there are four categories of people who are nechshavim kemeis. Now, the literal translator is they're thought of as if they're dead. We have to be very careful with chazal. I think I've mentioned this to you. When chazal makes what sound like absolute statements, it's often meant only in one respect, only in one dimension, only in one application. So they are really alive and they do mitzvos and you can be satisfied with their mitzvos and if they have troubles you have to help them. What are the four categories? Someone who's poor, someone who's blind, someone who's childless, and someone who is a mitzora, which is mistranslated as leper, has tzaras. In what way are these four comparable to the dead? What do they have in common? Here's what they have in common. That each of them lacks the normal range of application for loving kindness. Each one of them is handicapped in loving kindness. Poor person is handicapped because he hasn't got the money to help others. He can help others in other ways. I don't say he's totally excluded, but he's handicapped. Yes, if you need help crossing the street, he can help you cross the street, but he can't give you a place to sleep for the night. He hasn't got a place to sleep for the night that he can give you.
What's loving kindness? Loving kindness?
Okay, yeah. It's chesed. A blind person will never give you a lift to the store, and he can't help you decorate your living room, and he can't help you balance your books, and he can't program your computer for you. A blind person and needs help. He needs help with people, from people. Doesn't mean he can't do anything. He could give advice how to solve your problems and so forth and so on. But the normal range of applications of chesed, loving kindness, are not open to him. Childless person, when you will have children, you will know that your children call out in you expressions of loving kindness that you would never believe that you had in you. Imagine waking up at 2:30 in the morning and pacing the floor for 2 hours and you're not irritated, you're not upset, you're not anxious, because your child is crying. And all you know is, I have to comfort my child. And your feelings, the fact that you're going to be tired the next day, they don't even occur to you. Because the child's needs call out in you an outpouring of kindness and care and concern that you didn't even know. People who are childless don't have that. And a person who has tzaras is, by law, isolated. He has to live outside the city. If somebody approaches, he has to yell to him and warn to him not to approach. He's totally cut him off from you in society. So, of course, the range of application for... he could send the money order in the mail and give somebody some money, but the normal range of applications of chesed he doesn't have. Now, the Chazal say they're nechshavim kemeis. that they are in some respect parallel to the dead. In what respect are they parallel to the dead? Because life is giving. Real life is giving. Real life is being godlike, which means giving. And if a person is handicapped in giving, he's handicapped in life. This is how this principle applies over and over again. Okay. Now, Rav Dessler goes on in chapter 4. There is no person in the world without at least a spark of giving. Why would you think that is? Everyone in the world has at least a spark of giving. Okay, but I mean that's working it backwards. What's the explanation of it? It's really very simple. He has a soul. He has a divine soul. And that divine soul is going to express divinity. And since what God is for us is giving, of course there's got to be some spark of giving in every person just because he has a soul. And Tessa says you can see this in his rejoicing. That his rejoicing is not perfect, it's not complete when he's alone. And he longs for friends who from the depths of the soul will come and share it with him. Did you ever think a person has a celebration? He's celebrating something. He graduated from college. He got a new job or whatever it is. He throws a party. Why does he do that? He's giving everybody else free dinners and free drinks and free entertainment. What has that got to do with his success? Because the joy of the success is greatly magnified if you can share it with other people. If you're giving to other people out of your success, that makes your enjoyment of the success a greater enjoyment. That shows that the element of giving is there, and when you're happy, that element is activated, and you want other people to share the joy that you have. If you win the lottery, you'll throw a banquet. Right? Why? For that very reason. He says, as a parenthesis, one of the great punishments that you have for a person who is consistently and viciously bad is solitary confinement. Right? Solitary confinement means that it's impossible to give to another person. It's impossible to give to another person.
Well, I think it's worse than that.
It may be worse than that, but this is a necessary element. Let me ask you a question. How do you feel when someone asks you for advice? Good. Don't you feel terrific? Wow. First of all, he's crediting me. I know something worth knowing. I have information that's worth knowing. Second of all, I can help him. And I can feel that I improved him. So that because the desire to give is there, and he's enabling you to give. That's what it's triggering. Why do people want children? One reason is because they want a continuation of themselves, even after they leave the world. And especially if you see your children walking in your footsteps, you see them taking the abilities that you gave them and using them well, so you do feel that they are an extension of your presence in the world. And that's definitely an element in a person's psychology. Oh, we're running out of time. But also, children are an enormous opportunity to invest. Children at the beginning depend upon you for everything. When someone depends upon you, just as you said with respect to giving advice, here the child depends upon me for his life, for his protection, for his health. So, look at what I'm providing. Now, when I'm providing, that builds me up. In pnimius, in the root of a person. Why? Because it gives expression to my godliness. I'm doing what God is doing. What greater confirmation, what greater satisfaction can you have than you're doing what God is doing? You're godlike. Now you have this idea in perverted fashion where people want to be godlike for having power over everyone, or being godlike having the ability to have unlimited resources. But that's a perversion of the idea. The really godlike person is the one who does what God is doing. And God is not exercising power over everyone or taking everything to himself. God is giving. And when you give, that is the deepest human satisfaction, because you know that you're moving the world the way God moves the world. There's nothing higher that a person can do than that. Okay, continue with it tomorrow, Yisrael Hashem. Thank you very much. I'll be back to the battery. I'll take these home and charge them tonight, Yisrael Hashem.
Yeah, they're rechargeable batteries.
The ones that I have are rechargeable batteries. See, now this worked well, and it still says that it's full. So I understand what's going on with the other ones.